Canava from Mr. Jeremy Lee as the secretary of one of the major divisions of the League, the Institute of Economic Democracy. He's been very much involved in the League for many years. He's been involved not only in farming, but also in mining and many, shall we say, diverse activities. So Mr. Cronin is your chairman for this session.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Ladies and gentlemen, the title of the second paper today is simply in Building the World State Through Financial Debt. The importance of this subject to each of us as individuals will become more evident as the nation's debt level keeps increasing and the individual's control over his or her own affairs becomes less and less, if the nation's mounting debt levels eventually subject us or Australia to some form of international control. But to explain this and outline all the implications encompassed in this subject, we have with us today Mr. Jeremy Lee, one of Australia's best known and most talented public speakers. Jeremy was born in Kenya and educated at a well-known English public school. He's an outstanding authority on the new international economic order threat to national independence and the manipulation of the astronomical debt, which very likely could destroy and probably intended to destroy private enterprise. Mr. Lee is the most informed speaker on the debt swap for wilderness areas in Australia story. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Mr. Lee to take charge of this subject for us today. Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Eric Butler, Dr. Mitchell, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to begin by first of all saying how much I appreciate the chance once again to come and speak at this seminar and to meet so many old friends and also to take part in the enormous upsurge in interest that we can see all around Australia now, which is one of the most heartening aspects of our period. I really feel that the referendum result that we had on September the 3rd, while not being able to put one's finger on any specific thing that came out of it, does seem to have marked a turning point. I think there is a change of direction. One can feel quite a tangible awakening throughout this country, which is manifesting itself in many encouraging forms. And I want to perhaps conclude with some examples of why that is so and what is happening. But of course, it is also true that the standard of performance of our government is certainly not improving. It's almost changed from tragedy to high drama, or high comedy, you might say. Some of the things are quite extraordinary. The reaction, obviously, of the Labour Party to that referendum, having emphasised, as the Prime Minister did on a number of occasions, how deeply he trusted the innate wisdom of the Australian people. One noticed that he didn't pay quite such a loud tribute to that innate wisdom after the referendum result. He was too busy licking his wounds. On the other hand, the opposition, what there is of it, took all the credit for really a performance that they had very little to do with. It was an enormous upsurge of the ordinary Australian people rather than any particular party which was responsible for that change. But they have so little to crow about that one hardly begrudged them the loud barnyard noises that came out as a result. But nevertheless, they moved from there to the situation where the leader of the opposition ventured, I think almost with both eyes shut, into the minefield of the immigration issue, and found the water was extremely hot and was forced then to sack from his own shadow cabinet a man who simply put into words what he'd been trying to hint at. And that then resulted in the attitude from our Prime Minister of high moral rectitude, in which he took the situation that racism was the greatest crime of all and that he would be quite happy to fight an election on that issue. Whether he won or lost, he saw it as so important. And that might place into some sort of context the article which came out in the Weekend Australian about a week ago, September the 24th, 25th, which was written by Professor Geoffrey Blainey. Some of you might have seen this, but it struck me as epitomizing the whole hypocrisy of what is going on in Australia. And he's talking about the hypocrisy of Mr. Hawke, and in his article he revealed this. There was a revealing episode in the by-election for the federal seat of Adelaide in February. This is Professor Blainey writing. While Mr. Hawke's party avidly sought the ethnic vote, on the plea that his was the party of multiculturalism and of Asian immigration, it appealed for the Australian vote by concealing the fact that the endorsed Labour candidate had a charming Filipino wife. According to the Federal Hansard, August the 25th, high officials in the Labour Party, presumably with Mr. Hawke's blessing, decided that the publicity photograph of the Labour candidate would attract more votes if his Asian wife and his child were replaced in a garden setting by a fill-in wife and children. And that is what transpired in that election. Now, that is the party that is telling us the grim facts about racial prejudice and all the rest of it. I mean, really, Shakespeare would have been hard put to it to make a comedy out of that one. And that was then followed by a situation where just after the referendum, the Logos Foundation up in Toowoomba received a most congratulatory telephone call from one of the Rat Pack, as Mr. Henderson of the Institute of Public Affairs has called them, the Canberra Press Gallery, by the name of Laurie Oakes, who was all over them like a rash and told them what a marvelous job they'd done and how all the press gallery and the politicians were aware, even without articulating it, that basically it was the awakening amongst the ordinary people that had produced such a tremendous swing, and saying how he'd run into literature like wake-up papers and league pamphlets and other material that had been published by ordinary groups everywhere that he went, and what a marvelous change this was, which was simply the Rat Pack's way of fishing for enough information to make another defamatory article, which appeared in the Bulletin shortly after that, written by the selfsame Laurie Oakes, in which he castigated everybody and linked everybody together and warned of the might of the far right, whatever that happens to be. But even in the process of an article which honestly doesn't carry very much weight these days, I think people are beginning to see through the media, he did make a few concessions, and he started his article in this way, which I thought was interesting. On a cold winter night 3 months ago, more than 800 people packed in a high school auditorium in the Brisbane suburb of Kelvin Grove for a political meeting. The Prime Minister could not attract a crowd that size in Brisbane or anywhere else, even in summer. Neither Paul Keating nor John Howard nor any mainstream politician would go close. Now, that happens to be the truth, but the only truthful bit in the article. But it is true that the politics of this country is moving further and further away from those who claim to have something to do with it, who are the politicians. But he then goes on to belt, as usual, I don't think you're allowed to write articles for the Bulletin unless you do this, the League of Rights, as hard as he possibly could, for their books and their behavior and their secretiveness and a whole lot of things that don't exist. But when you boil it all down, the thing that has him rabid is this idea that there could actually be a conspiracy. And anybody who talks about a conspiracy immediately places himself beyond the pale, and this is the most heinous crime, which really is epitomized by the League of Rights. And he says this: the One World conspiracy has a particular advantage from the League of Rights point of view. It can be adapted to appeal to any disaffected group in the community. Lee, in the Enterprise magazine published by the League's Institute of Economic Democracy, adapted the theory to cover the effect of World Heritage listing on Queensland timber workers. Under the guise of protecting the environment, a breathtaking international plan is being devised for linking World Heritage areas to the equity base of world bankers and the operation of a future money system, the magazine reported. Referring to the attendance of London banker Edmund de Rothschild at a World Wilderness Conference in Cairns in 1980, it wondered what a prominent member of the most financial institution on earth was doing in such an organization. Quote, in the light of a suggestion last year that a World Conservation Bank could help third world countries counter environmental degradation, the answer was obvious to the spokesman of the ultra-right at any rate. This year, Lee undertook a lecture tour of North Queensland to alert worried timber workers to the conspiracy. Now, he doesn't, of course, go on to add that the same Edmund de Rothschild was a speaker at the Fourth World Wilderness Congress, and in fact, the Fourth World Wilderness Congress, where the whole proposition for a debt for nature swap was established and is now being propagated by the United Nations, wasn't even mentioned. The nearest he came to it was the fact that he attended a conference in 1980. In other words, it was a scam-type article of the worst type without any attempt to analyze what evidence there is either for or against such a proposition. And that is the reason, I believe, why so many Australians now distrust the media and are hostile to the media. And what I'd like to do in this paper, therefore, is to try and give you some evidence, some background, on a history which goes right back through the century and which it is very hard to argue about. And really, we've got to go back, I think, to that period during the First World War when the first base for what you could call the international idea, embodying both humanism and socialism, all mixed into a potent amalgam, was materialized in the form of not the first revolution in Russia, but the second revolution that year. The first revolution had been a much more peaceful affair, and it was then taken out of the hands of those who'd been involved by an October revolution, which, as has been pointed out by Eric earlier on, was manufactured and financed in the Western world, was, in Churchill's word, injected into the situation as a vial of poison with the aid of Allied forces fighting during that First World War, and produced the first materialistic government on earth for communism under the master tactician and planner Lenin. And no sooner had they established themselves than into the Soviet Union, this new Soviet, went a stream of socialists from the Western world who were so convinced that some new type of utopia had been established that they were quite prepared to discount any of the evidence of what was really happening. The grim massacres, the mass starvation of kulaks, which resulted in a real Holocaust of 7 million deaths at that particular time, of starved to death, the tremendous persecution, the establishment of a great archipelago of concentration camps, now described by Solzhenitsyn as the Gulag Archipelago, all that was discounted by the Sidney Webbs and the Archdeacon of Canterbury, Hewlett Johnson, and a stream of other reporters going in there ready to report back to the Western world on the magnificence of this new social experiment that was taking place on Russian soil. And only one or two had the honesty to begin to change their views, one of whom obviously was Malcolm Muggeridge, who'd gone through there as a reporter for the Manchester Guardian, filled with the same zeal that the others had, filled also with the fact that the whole of his upbringing had been in that Fabian establishment, the first early meetings had often taken place in the home of his parents, but who was also innately honest enough to begin to see the disparity between what he believed and what was actually happening, and he sent back to his paper in London some honest accounts of what he saw, and was amazed to discover they didn't want to print that. They only wanted pictures that would fit in with the preconceived vision they had, and it was that which led him to cast his first doubts on the whole socialist movement and ethos, and to see it for the sham it really was. And from that point, led him ultimately to break with Fabianism and accept Christianity so well described in that book he wrote, Surprised by Joy. And he's one of the few honest men that came out of that. But the stream of visitors went on, and back in the Western world, little clubs and groups began to meet to try and repeat in the Western world what had happened in the Soviet Union, according to their particular theories. But we've got to remember that from the point it was established, the long-term vision of the communist movement, particularly articulated by Lenin, never really changed at all. And so broadly, they broke their program, their future program, into two parts. The first one was a revolutionary movement which had to be sent like a vial of poison back into the rest of the world, the third world, first into Germany and then from there through Peking and London and Paris and right through down to all the third world countries. And the second part was that having disrupted and disorganized the economies of the Western world to try and bring all that together into some type of unitary system. And so an immense amount of effort was put into the breakup of the old established empires and the Western system, and particularly the attack on Christianity. And this came together finally after a number of conferences of the Communist International in 1936, which was one of the most significant conferences, because here was articulated a program which we can see unfolding in the Western world at the present time. And I might just read this for you. The international order concept was first developed at a special Moscow economic conference in 1952. That's where they began to concentrate on it. But the planning documents were put in place much earlier. Lenin himself had foreshadowed this development to follow the anti-colonial program in these words: "The more backward the country, the more difficult it is for her to pass from the old capitalist relations to socialist relations. To the task of destruction are added new incredibly difficult tasks, i.e. organizational tasks, the organization of accounting, of the control of large enterprises, the transformation of the whole of the state economic mechanism into a single huge machine, into an economic organization that will work in such a way as to enable hundreds of millions of people to be guided by a single plan." Lenin, early 20s. You can find that in his selected works, which are still published and read avidly by the Communist Party. And in 1936, the Communist International came together in Moscow and formalized this into a three-stage plan for achieving world government, which was as follows. One, socialize the economies of all nations. Two, bring about regional unions of various groupings of these socialized nations. And three, amalgamate all of these regional groupings into a final worldwide union of socialist states. 1936. Regional groupings, from regional groupings across to one world system. Now, this was the period when Lenin had been replaced by an even more vicious character by the name of Joseph Stalin, and he himself dealt with this in the book Marxism and the National Question, which, of course, was used in the formulation of that 1936 program, when in 1928 and again in 1936, Stalin had set out the program along these steps. One, confuse, disorganize, and destroy the forces of capitalism around the world. Two, bring all nations into a single world system of economy. Three, force the advanced nations, the advanced countries, to pour prolonged financial aid into the underdeveloped countries. Four, divide the world into regional groups as a transitional stage to total world government. The reason being, populations will more readily abandon their national loyalties to a vague regional loyalty than they will for a world authority. Later, the regionals, such as the present NATO, CETO, and the Organization of American States, can be brought all the way into a single world dictatorship of the proletariat. Stalin in the late 20s and early 30s, Marxism and the National Question. And really, there's been very little deviation from that plan since that time, and we can see it materializing at the present time. The first great attempt, I suppose, was at the end of the Second World War, when it was considered by the communist movement they had achieved sufficient in the revolutionary field to begin to concentrate on the second part of the program. There had already been set in motion all the machinery for the breakup of the colonial powers. The great scramble out of Africa was beginning. The first revolutionary wars were being fought in the world. The Malayan campaign with Australian troops up in that part of the world was already in progress. The Mau Mau campaign in my home country of Kenya had started at that time. The great debates of the Fabian movement and others, the setting up of left-wing movements to pour financing to revolutionary movements throughout the old British world, was working apace. All that was in progress. And so in 1952, a tremendously significant conference was held in Moscow. And that was to bring people into this realization that we have the revolutionary program going, the breakup of the capitalist world is in progress. Now we concentrate on the next stage, which is to set in motion the mechanism for some sort of economic union, some sort of new world order or economic order. And that conference really was the start of what we're seeing today. Very significant for the fact that one of those from the Western world who went back to that conference in 52, leading a communist delegation, later became the Prime Minister of Canada, Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Prior to that, a prohibited immigrant into the United States, strong member of the communist movement, had actually been caught, apprehended, gun running into Cuba to help the Castro revolution, but had then inveigled his way into the Liberal Party of all things subsequently and became a prime minister who did more damage to our sister Commonwealth country than probably any single person. He was there in 1952 in Moscow, leading a communist delegation to concentrate on this concept of the new international economic order. It was an amazing period. The Fabian Society was putting its act together. It was regrouping at the end of the war, the Socialist International, which had originally been formed by Marx right back in the middle of the 1800s, and had fallen into disarray after the Lenin movement and the Bolshevik Party had turned it into a revolutionary movement, was put together again in a great conference in Hamburg in 1951. Harold Wilson was one of those who took part. It subsequently established its own secretariat in London, which still operates. And if you open up, for example, the Australian Labour Party 82 platform, that platform which had been set up just before Bob Hawke came to power, you will see the ALP affiliated with the Socialist International, whose open written objectives, not whose secret objectives or hinted objectives, but whose written objectives are, we believe the final end is world government. How Laurie Oakes can claim that there is no evidence of a conspiracy is absolute nonsense. It's all there in writing if we want to go and have a look at it. It was the period where some of the characters who've done so much damage in Australia were at university back in England. There was a young student at Oxford by the name of Malcolm Fraser. And at the same time at Oxford, or either at the same time or shortly after, was another, an interesting character by the name of Ian McLaughlin, who later became the head of the National Farmers Federation and produced such a disaster in that particular movement. One can hardly say that there was any collusion, I don't know that, but it was out of that period at both Oxford and Cambridge at that time that so much of the poison we're contending with now began to flow. And you can only assume that there was a tremendous penetration at the teaching level into both those two universities whose history goes right back thousands of years, or hundreds of years, in British history. And it wasn't terribly long after that, in fact it was the year that I came to Australia, that two most courageous Australians, who were not infected with that disease, went back to Britain to lecture right across on the dangers of the first regional grouping set up along the lines which had been propounded by the Communist International in 1936 and by Joseph Stalin. And one of those was our National Director of the League of Rights, Eric Butler, and alongside him a man who has, I think, weakened somewhat since that time, a young man later to become an Australian Liberal Minister, Minister for Defence, Jim Killen, who lectured throughout Britain trying to warn the British people of the implications of a treaty they had been persuaded to sign, or were being persuaded to sign at that time, the Treaty of Rome, which set up the whole European common market concept as we see it today. What were the implications of that for the British world? What were the implications for the Crown? What were the implications for national sovereignty? Did this mean ultimately that some sort of political control would come in? All this was discussed, and the evidence behind the idea propounded, and while many British politicians privately agreed that there was a danger, they were caught up in the sort of enthusiasm for unity, which was the in-vogue religion of that particular time. But nevertheless, the groundwork was set in place in Britain, which ultimately began to grow into an understanding, still working today, of the dangers of the European common market. And we saw ultimately the tremendous disease involved in that, in which politicians assured their critics that whatever else was said about the common market, it would never, never threaten Britain's sovereignty, would never involve any political type of unity, would never involve the transplantation of British common law. We saw all that dashed away and completely eroded 2 years ago, or just under 2 years ago, when finally before the British Parliament for signature went something called the Single European Act. The Single European Act. It went through the House of Commons without any comment at all. This was in the early part of 1987. And when it finally landed up in the House of Lords, only one or two brave men spoke out. One of them, one of the most eminent legal brains in Britain, Lord Denning, who warned that this would be the end of the monarchy if it was accepted, warned of all the implications of a heritage to a heritage that went right back to the founding of the Westminster system. But he was unheeded, and with heads bowed, his fellow peers shuffled by and voted yes to the Single European Act, which stipulated quite clearly that political power would be handed across to Brussels by the year 1992. One of the most iniquitous and frightful things that has been done, and we're now beginning to read something, for example, of the implications. September the 29th, in the Financial Review, we had a major feature article, Cracking the Mega Market, which was written by Andrew Clark, who seems to espouse all the left-wing causes. And in the prelude to this political article, he just sets it out quite simply. Can I read it to you? European unity inevitable. The single market will inevitably mean growing centralization of economic and political power in Europe at the expense of the sovereignty of the 12 member nations. There it is, as bluntly as you like. Economic and political power of Europe at the expense of the sovereignty of the 12 member nations. The growing administrative discretion flowing to Brussels is already cutting back the separate powers of the member governments. And this is one of the reasons why European Commission President Mr. Jacques Delors has spoken of the need of the development of a European government. Europeans have coined a term for this movement of power to Brussels, functional spillover. This is the process by which the integration in any area of economic life, coal and steel planning, for example, will gradually spill over into other areas also. And it goes on to try and explain the implications of that for Australian trade. In the same issue, we had an article on the latest decision that has come from the European Court, which is headed European Court Affirms the Rome Treaty Coverage. And the latest ruling of the European Court is that they can now overrule any national government in its administration of corporate affairs, and this is interesting in light of what Dr. Mitchell was telling us about the corporate affairs power in this particular area, corporate affairs in Europe, and the dealing with transnational companies. Whether that's going to be held or not remains to be seen. So that was what is now coming out. Even more interesting was this article which came out in the Australian in August the 13th to the 14th. Some of you might have seen this, but it's the first time I've ever seen a title like this. The actual article was headed The New World Order. Presumably something which Laurie Oakes doesn't believe exists. It's a sort of figment in the mind of conspiratorialists like that dreadful League of Rights. The fact that the paper he is writing in also contains articles on the New World Order doesn't seem to have occurred to him. How ridiculous he looks. And it went on to say this. A few weeks ago in London, the European Commission External Relations Commissioner, Willie de Klerk, said, "Euro-pessimism is a story of the past. 1992 has given Europe confidence in its destiny. This is important for Europe, but not less for the international economic system. European Economic Union will shake national political sovereignty in a decisive way. The Euro zealots want a central bank for Europe. The essential shift of a common currency and tax standardization, notably in VAT, value-added tax. The president of the European Commission, Jacques Delors, put it bluntly. In 10 years, 80% of economic legislation and perhaps tax and social legislation will be directed from the community. This is an omen. The threat to national sovereignty is why skeptics abound about the timing and extent of the union. The most influential skeptic is the British leader, Margaret Thatcher. No politician likes to surrender power. No nation likes to shed its sovereignty. Well, one's got to question that particular remark, because if you go and look at the vote in the House of Commons, the whole of Margaret Thatcher's party voted for the Single European Act. Margaret Thatcher herself, despite a very strong personal display, which certainly contrasts favorably with leaders like John Howard, nevertheless has been to a number of Bilderberg meetings out of which much of this sort of idea has been shaped. And so, in my mind, a question mark, and it is only a question mark, still hangs over the position that Margaret Thatcher takes. But while all this tremendous pressure has built to shift the power of Europe more and more past its original concept into a United States of Europe as a transitional region prior to world government, what is happening in our particular quarter? And in the Pacific, we have had an incredibly significant article which has come out. If I may just quote this, came out in the Financial Review, August the 15th. This is only about 6 weeks ago, about a proposition put by Mike Mansfield, the United States ambassador to Japan, that the next step and an urgent step is the building of a common market between Japan and the United States of America. Now, you might think this is something new in the figment of his imagination, but of course it came out of the Trilateral Commission, which has been working on this idea for some time. The significance of this article is it is now being openly canvassed in our media. The Mansfield solution is a free trade area in which the two governments would agree over a certain number of years to sweep away tariffs and other trade barriers. They would also empower binational panels. Now, these are obviously power panels set up with the power to rule in both nations. In other words, it is a transfer of sovereignty to make binding decisions to resolve disputes. As for such an arrangement with Japan, the general view when Mr. Mansfield made the initial proposal early in the 1980s was that it was ridiculous to talk about a free trade arrangement between two countries of such differing legal systems and cultures. But the longer the Mansfield idea was on the table, the more intriguing it became. This year, it has received a nudge from some influential people, including two former secretaries of state, Henry Kissinger and Cyrus Vance, both members of the Trilateral Commission, both members of the Carter cabinet, which did so much to wreck national sovereignty, and they have been working feverishly on this idea. It has been followed, incidentally, with the latest proposal came out yesterday that the time has come to remove the American dollar as the world's reserve currency and to replace it with the Japanese yen. Are they receiving any backing in Australia? Well, that's very significant because we've just had this article, 29th of September, came out in the Financial Review. The former Prime Minister, Mr. Malcolm Fraser, said yesterday it was time to explore the prospects of trade, economic and financial ties with Japan and other countries in the Asia-Pacific region. He said the region had been discriminated against by North America and Europe, which had formed themselves into trading blocs. They have made it plain that they're going to use their size and power to negotiate trading arrangements which are acceptable to them, he said. Australia and many other countries in Asia are relatively defenseless against these circumstances, and so they act by themselves. If Japan, Australia, and other fast-growing countries in Asia were able to form a trade, financial, and economic association, then it would give some weight to our arm. Mr. Fraser was speaking before a lunch in Sydney of an economic report by IBIS Business Information called Australia Tomorrow, which argues that in purely economic terms, the world is tending to regionalize rather than globalize. In other words, they're in the first stage of what Stalin and the Comintern proposed, which is simply transitional for the second. With the emergence of four main economic blocs, North America, Asia Pacific, Western Europe, and the Soviet bloc. This was 2 days ago. Mr. Fraser must have been in a little rush because he left that luncheon to get on a plane and is currently in Zimbabwe, where he's speaking at a big conference, and his ambition, according to press reports, is to gain the support of men like Mugabe and other former allies in his pursuit of the job of Secretary General of the Commonwealth Secretariat, which is being vacated by Mr. Sonny Ramphal, another advocate of world government. So Malcolm Fraser is still busy in the field of international politics. And so it goes. That is the Pacific at the present time, but we've also got to realize that the Pacific is emerging as a focal point of enormous importance, and that is why Moscow is more and more concerned in our Pacific region, because it is very interested in the whole question of closer economic relations and is pursuing the same line as a man called Mike Moore, who is in the Longy cabinet in New Zealand, who has written a book on the need for a Pacific Parliament of the equivalent of the European Common Market Parliament, which can begin to take over power from all its different ingredient members in the Pacific. We need a Pacific trading area. And so this information recently came out In News Weekly, Moscow has recently established a Southwest Pacific division of its foreign office, which is the diplomatic agency of the International Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union to deal with Vanuatu. There is no doubt at all that this new department will be working to program Vanuatu to play the same key island role in the expansion of Soviet influence as it does, as does Cuba in relation to Central and South America and Malta in the Western Mediterranean. Quite apart from the question of whether Libya is supplying guns to radicals in the Pacific, the purpose of the Soviet program in Vanuatu is to launder money, propaganda, organizers, agents, and ordinary protectionist rackets to intimidate voters throughout the entire Pacific island chain. The key to this is the current Vanuatu government led by Leni and Sopi, which just happens to be the unit they're using at the present time. But it's also instructive to learn that the key man working amongst the economic groups that are being exploited happens to be an Australian Labour Party official by the name of member called Mr. John Halfpenny, who has been selected quite obviously as the key Australian player in the Pacific region at the present time. Now, it's very interesting because the first communist paper that I read on the importance of the new international economic order was given by Mr. Laurie Carmichael, who stipulated that this was a major communist objective. The new international economic order was a major communist objective. In the meantime, Mr. John Halfpenny has been the key player in our Pacific region. Something of his background is relevant. The education of young John proceeded through the Eureka Youth League, in which his qualities of leadership became so apparent that the Central Committee of the Communist Party selected him to go for higher training into the Soviet Union. He studied full-time at one of Moscow's party schools for about 15 months, from 1961 to 1963, becoming an accomplished Russian speaker. He speaks fluently in Russian. During 1978, he made another unofficial week-long visit to the Soviet Union. His most important visit during 1978 was, however, to Prague, Czechoslovakia, where in company with Mr. Pat Clancy, whose pro-Soviet loyalty was beyond doubt, Mr. Halfpenny attended the conference of the World Federation of Trade Unions, which is an agency of the Soviet government. The Soviets' WFTU decided to organize a Pacific Trade Union Federation for reasons not entirely disconnected with Soviet policy in our region. On his return to Australia, Mr. Halfpenny assumed the central organizing role in this new body. He effectively directs it to the present day. The Pacific Trade Union Forum's published policies and statements have been uniformly hostile to the American presence in the South Pacific, to the French presence in New Caledonia, while remaining significantly silent on the now undisguised Soviet policy of penetrating the region. The next stage in the political odyssey of Mr. Halfpenny was reached in 1979 when he left the Communist Party to join the ALP, carefully emphasizing that he had not changed his views, but only the vehicle through which he would seek to realize them. Once again, his party colleagues were extremely understanding, with no sign of the accustomed odium theologicum. On behalf of the Victorian State Committee of the Communist Party of Australia, Mr. Bernie Taft issued a statement concluding, "We look forward to continue work with John Halfpenny as we do with others in the labor movement." This charitable objective was facilitated when some two-thirds of the Communist Party of Australia's State Committee followed John's footsteps. It was simply a repeat of what the Communist Party had done in Czechoslovakia in 1947 and 1948. But there's no doubt that Mr. Halfpenny is ready to fulfill his role in the emerging Pacific Basin, and that is why we have had, as Dr. Mitchell pointed out, the debate in Parliament about closer economic relations, which is simply a ploy. Now, we've had open talks about a merger between Australia and New Zealand, a common currency, and all this is the prelude material to repeat of what we have seen in the European common market, followed, obviously, by some sort of Pacific Parliament, a regional shift in power, which is the prelude to world government. It's all there. It's all documented. I can only deal with little bits of this. There's so much of it that anybody like Laurie Oakes who tries to pretend it isn't happening must have his sanity seriously questioned. I've got to say that. In the meantime, behind all this, there is the ultimate pressure which is forcing nations in this direction, and that is the growing world debt crisis. And so, as a result of that, we are beginning to get a picture of what is going on. For example, we've just had two major international conferences. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have just held their world conference, and this was followed by the G7 group, the seven major industrial economic group nations in the Western world having their meeting. The result of this was, and those of you who've studied the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund annual conferences would know that really they're something like a Roman orgy. The first one they had 2 years ago in Seoul, I think they had 110,000 delegates there. They took over hotels. They had seven cocktail parties a day. That was followed by an even bigger bash last year in Washington, where they took over every riverboat on the Potomac, and football teams were being flown in for the entertainment, and wine flowed like water and goodness knows what. And even bankers who attended were complaining at the high style of living of all these massive numbers of delegates as they met to discuss world poverty and hunger. Quite incredible. They've been doing the same again, this time in Berlin. They had a little bit of a rough time this time because they were met, strangely enough, by some of the conservation groups having violent demonstrations against the International Monetary Fund. A welcome change, in which they complain that the International Monetary Fund is forcing many of the impoverished nations into ecological destruction, which is true. But as a result of this somber meeting of the International Monetary Fund, they have issued their statement. It was the same as last year. They now fear a world trade slump. They produced their major economic report. The International Monetary Fund report highlights the risk of renewed world inflation, canvasses the benefits of a further earlier tightening of monetary policy, and they, in short, say we're going to have a major depression before too long. But they think they can keep it propped up until the American presidential election is over in November. At the same time, the United Nations has just issued its latest call for a world debt relief program, which was highlighted in the Financial Review in these words. I could hardly believe it when I read it. Opening sentence, sovereign states should be allowed to go bankrupt. How do you like that? Sovereign states should be allowed to go bankrupt. The United Nations Transnational Corporations has concluded in its report on the world debt crisis, which is now so monumentally out of control that nobody really knows what's going to happen. The 39 broke countries that we had in the third world last year borrowing money to pay the interest on what they'd borrowed previously has been joined rapidly by the major advanced industrial countries. We know something about Australia's foreign debt, which has gone through the roof, increasing at the rate, I think, of $6,000 a second at the present time. It's just blown out again, blasting all Mr. Keating's predictions. We are a cop case in terms of international debt at the present time. But we're not as bad as Canada, whose total debts are now quadrupled in a four-year period. And then to top that all off, the latest figures from the United States show that their total debt package has just topped $12 trillion and is much greater than the whole of the debt of the rest of the world put together. So to solve this problem, the United Nations proposes that all sovereign nations should be allowed to go bankrupt. It's awfully generous of them, really. But that they have a program ready to meet that crisis, which means that the whole decision-making process is handed over to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. It's all set out. It's all set out in the very papers in which Oakes also writes that anybody who talks like this has got some sort of conspiratorial imbecility about him. It's mind-boggling stuff. So that's what's happening at the present time. The situation in the United States with regard to what is happening in the economic world is absolutely staggering. For example, a report has just been issued on what is happening in the field of mergers and takeovers. It is now predicted by the end of this century there will be no family farms left in America. That's hardly surprising. We're getting the same predictions here. The latest issue that I've seen of Business Review Weekly had as its major title across the front cover, the new sunrise industry. What is the sunrise industry? International corporate control farming. This is the get into that one. The farmers are gone. The internationalists are taking over. This is the new sunrise industry in Australia. Well, they set out in this particular article on what's happening in America a picture of what is happening in the field of mergers. And they are literally having thousands and thousands of mergers, the centralization of power, over the last 8 years, from 1980 through to 1986. This is very interesting because the Brandt Commission report, which is the socialist international document, really, the blueprint for the world government idea, did point out, and I think accurately, that by 1978, one-third of the world's production was in the hands of 500 companies now. One-third of the world's production. But that was 8 years ago, 10 years ago. Since that time, they've had mergers in America in a six-year period which have totaled $665,000 million. $665,000 million. And the last one was 1986, available figures, where they had $190 billion worth of takeovers in that 12-month period alone.